Now again, everyone is very warmly welcome. We appreciate all who have made good effort and some very considerable effort to be here. And we thank you for coming. The one night remains tomorrow night again at 8 o'clock. And if you're able to make it, you know that you'll be most welcome. Your presence will be appreciated. Now we're still reading in Deuteronomy, and as in previous nights, we tried to take a section of the book. And tonight we'll start to read in chapter 18. The section really begins at 19, but I want to read a little in chapter 18 of the book of Deuteronomy and verse 9. Deuteronomy 18 and verse 9. When thou art come into the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, thou shalt not learn to do after the abominations of those nations. There shall not be found among you any one that maketh his son or his daughter to pass through the fire, or that useth divination, or an observer of times, or an enchanter, or a witch, or a charmer, or a consulter with familiar spirits, or a wizard, or a necromancer. For all that do these things are an abomination unto the Lord, and because of these abominations, the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee. Thou shalt be perfect with the Lord thy God. Now, chapter 19. We'll read very briefly, selectively from these chapters. Chapter 19, verse 16. If a false witness rise up against any man to testify against him that which is wrong, then both the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges which shall be in those days. And the judges shall make diligent inquisition, and behold, if the witness be a false witness and hath testified falsely against his brother, then shall ye do unto him as he hath thought to have done unto his brother. So shalt thou put the evil away from among you. Now, chapter 20 and verse 19. When thou shalt besiege a city a long time in making war against it to take it, thou shalt not destroy the trees thereof by forcing an axe against them, for thou mayest eat of them, and thou shalt not cut them down, for the tree of the field is man's life. Thou shalt not cut them down to employ them in the siege, only the trees which thou knowest that they be not trees for meat. Now chapter 21 we considered on Sunday night, so we'll go to chapter 22. Verse 1, thou shalt not see thy brother's ox or his sheep go astray and hide thyself from them. Thou shalt in any case bring them again unto thy brother. Verse 4, thou shalt not see thy brother's ass or his ox fall down by the way and hide thyself from them. Thou shalt surely help him to lift them up again. The woman shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all that do so are abomination unto the Lord thy God. And then we have the matter about the bird's nest. Verse 8, when thou buildest a new house, then thou shalt make a battlement for thy roof, that thou bring not blood upon thine house if any man fall from thence. Now, chapter 23, verse 17, there shall be no whore of the daughters of Israel, nor a sodomite of the sons of Israel. Thou shalt not bring the hire of a whore or the price of a dog into the house of the Lord thy God for any vow, for even both these are abomination unto the Lord thy God. Chapter 24, verse 5, when a man hath taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war, neither shall he be charged with any business, but he shall be free at home 1 year, and shall cheer up his wife which he hath taken. Verse 19, when thou cuttest down thine harvest in thy field, and hast forgot a sheaf in the field, thou shalt not go again to fetch it. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow, that the Lord thy God may bless thee in all the work of thine hands. When thou beatest thine olive tree, thou shalt not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the stranger, and for the fatherless, and for the widow. And the same with the grapes of the vineyard. Chapter 25, verse 1, if there be a controversy between men, and they shall come into judgment, that the judges may judge them, then they shall justify the righteous and condemn the wicked, and it shall be, if the wicked man be worthy to be beaten, that the judge shall cause him to lie down and to be beaten before his face, according to his fault, by a certain number. 40 stripes he may give him, and not exceed, lest if he should exceed and beat him above these with many stripes, then thy brother should seem vile unto thee. Thou shalt not muzzle the ox when he treadeth out the corn. And lastly, chapter 26. And it shall, verse 1, it shall be when thou art come into the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance, and possessest it and dwellest therein, that thou shalt take of the first of all the fruit of the earth which thou shalt bring of thy land that the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shall put it in a basket, and shall go unto the place which the Lord thy God shall choose to place his name there. Thou shalt go unto the priest that shall be in those days, and say unto him, I profess this day unto the Lord thy God that I am come into the country which the Lord swore unto our fathers for to give us. And the priest shall take the basket out of thine hand and set it down before the altar of the Lord thy God. And then we have the confession that was made. Maybe we should just read verse 18 of 26. The Lord hath avouched thee this day to be his peculiar people, as he hath promised thee, that thou shouldest keep all his commandments, and to make thee high above all nations which he hath made, in praise and in name and in honour, and that thou mayest be an holy people unto the Lord thy God, as he hath spoken. Now, again, that's a tremendous amount of reading, and we trust that the Lord will help us at least to derive some spiritual benefit from it. I'm fairly sure that the folks here, you will have known what it is to start out on a journey, maybe at the time of the year when there is snow or whatever, and about two-thirds of the way through, the thing becomes so difficult that you say to yourself, why did we ever start? And I think that many people, when they read the book of Deuteronomy, when they get to about chapter 19 and get two-thirds of the way through, they have the similar type of feeling. They say, why did we ever start? It's becoming deeper and more difficult, and to a certain extent that is the case. I think there are maybe three, possibly four reasons why, generally speaking, Christians have avoided this book of Deuteronomy. Number one, it is lengthy. And that, of course, is against the grain of the present day. We live in the day of sound bites, and things have to be short and snappy if we are going to listen to them. Anything that's lengthy and demanding, well, we just give it a bye. And unfortunately, many of the books of the Bible are lengthy, so that we have to get above the general attitude of our culture when it comes to Scripture. Second reason is that it's legal. People don't find legal material easy reading. It can be very dry and uninteresting. A third reason is that it's bloodthirsty. These pages drip with blood. The violence of Deuteronomy is quite horrendous. It's one of the books of the Bible that has given the critics a very, very serious weapon that they can use against inspiration. That God commanded his people to go into a land and to eliminate man, woman, and child, and suckling infant. They say, if that's the God of the Bible, well, let him be like that, but if he's as brutal as that, I want nothing to do with him. So because we find the book of Deuteronomy a little bit uncomfortable because of its bloodthirstiness, we avoid it as well. And then, to crown it out, of course, the most of it is obsolete. It doesn't belong to us anyway. It's a previous dispensation. It's a whole list of rules and regulations that are long since beyond their shelf life, so that we're only expending needless mental energy to come back and to battle with these chapters. Well, I think maybe there is a different approach. I think there is some benefit from spending time with it, and hence we have invested this week with it in Blue River. As we have mentioned on a number of nights, and if the journey is getting difficult for those who have been able to be with us every night, for the good folks whom we're delighted to see tonight and you have just dropped in. Well, I intended to get sympathy cards printed for you at the door, but I didn't manage, but just do your best, son. And one thing I'll ask from you, the primary request is that you pray. But if you can't pray and you're not spiritual enough to pray, in God's name, please don't sleep. And at least that will be a great help to me as we wade through these very unusual chapters. It's the farewell ministry of Moses. He's looking upon a generation whom he loves, a generation of young people. And he's wanting to give them his last messages. And we have the final ministry of Moses, the man of God. He has been associated with these people for now quite a number of decades. His ministry to them has been very varied. He has treated them in every stage of their experience so far. He has given them a variety of ministry. When he first made contact with them in the book of Exodus, they were prisoners. And he preached to them according to their need then. And he brought them from captivity into freedom. Then, when they were out into freedom, he addressed them as priests. And the ministry of the book of Leviticus, it came into its own. And we have that great priestly, sacrificial book of Leviticus. But then, when they began to take their journey through the wilderness, and the man who first touched them as prisoners, and then spoke to them as priests, he led them and he comforted them as pilgrims through the wilderness in the book of Numbers. Now, the most of that generation has passed. A new generation has arisen. And Moses is about to take his leave. And he deals with them in the book of Deuteronomy as pupils. And they're at his feet. And they're listening to his voice. And they are scholars in his college. And he is seeking to teach them the lessons which they will need to know at this particular stage in their experience. They're just at the edge of the River Jordan in the plains of Moab. They're about to cross over into Canaan. And the reason that Moses teaches these pupils these lessons of Deuteronomy is because they are going to have to cope with the challenge of the culture of Canaan. And that will be a big challenge. And Moses wants to equip them to cope with that culture that they will shortly face. He will hand over the reins of leadership to another man. And the people who began as prisoners and became priests and were pilgrims and are now pupils, under the leadership of Joshua, that same people will become possessors. And they will go into the land of Canaan and they will claim the land for the glory of God and claim it for their own blessed enjoyment. So that gives you a very broad context in which we can think about the book of Deuteronomy. Now so far, and again I just mention this in passing, but so that we can move on into this particular section. In the early chapters, chapters 1 to 4, Moses was seeking to instruct these people as to the right path. Now he said there's a way. There's a way by which God leads his people. And if they're going to go on and go on with God, he said they'll have to be willing to go. He said, whatever you do, don't be like your fathers, because they got along the path and then they froze. And he said they started to drag their feet. And when they got to Kadesh Barnea, instead of pressing on the path with God, they turned their heels and turned their heads and they headed back to Egypt and they lost the whole business for over 30 years. But he said, keep pressing on. Keep facing forward. Keep going on with God. And I would say that to the dear believers here in Blue River, we might never meet again. But dear Christians, whatever you do, no matter how difficult it might be to keep forward with God, never start looking back to Egypt, because God has a path for his people. And that's the path that Moses emphasizes in chapters 1 to 4. In chapters 5 to 11, you know that we emphasized that the people on this path, if they are going to be able to keep the path, it will be absolutely essential that they have the right priorities. If we get the wrong prayer, that's why he says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy might, with all thy soul, with all thy strength. He said, in your life, he said, keep God and the things of God as priority number one. And he said, that will not only preserve your feet, it will maintain your focus. That's the second section of the book. Last night, we went to the third large section of the book, from chapters 12 through to chapter 18. I mentioned, for those who were able to be here, that 21 times in the book of Deuteronomy you get the expression similar to this, the place which the Lord thy God shall choose to put his name there. 21 times. 19 of those occurrences are all between chapters 12 and 18. So those 7 chapters are the great chapters that tell the people, now you're on a path. On that path, the Lord is your single priority. Now he said, that will bring you to a place. And he said, the place where the Lord will place his name. We considered some of the features of that place last night as illustrated here. And I still believe that, dear Christians. I still believe that firmly. You may have different ideas. I still believe, maybe I'm naive, that if a person saved, if they take the path of the Lord's appointment, if they make the Lord the single ambition of their heart, there's one thing sure, that that person, sooner or later, and probably sooner rather than later, will find himself or herself in the place of the name gathered to the Lord Jesus alone. He said in the land of Canaan, it will be absolutely littered with places. And he said, the land of Canaan will be crammed with the names of false gods. He said, I am going to acknowledge none of those places. I'm going to identify with none of those names. It will be one place. It will be one name. It will be exclusive. And he said, have absolutely nothing to do with those other places. No talk. No fellowship. No compromise. Whatsoever, he said, leave the heathendom and the paganism of Canaanitish religion. He said, in fact, destroy it. And he said, you be intolerant of everything that compromises the glory of my exclusive name. So the path and the priority leads to the place. Now, that brings us then tonight right into chapters 19 through to chapter 26. And one of the features of these chapters is that we are going to learn the principles, the practical principles by which the people who are associated with the place will order their life. Now there will be a standard of behavior. The standard of behavior of the people who are linked with God's place will be far above. In fact, you might have noticed in the reading, just where we concluded our reading, at the end of chapter 26, God said, I want to make you a peculiar people. And he said, if you keep my word and obey my voice, he said, I will make you a people high above. He said, you'll be on a different level. You'll live your life on a different plane. He said, the Canaanitish culture into which you will be going is a culture that is just down. I'm going to say down in the very pits. He says, it's a groveling culture in the very filth of this world. But he said, you're going to go in as my holy people at a higher level. And so we have in these chapters these practical principles that apply when the people are in the land of Canaan. Now, one of the things that amazes a person, because we can't go into the details here tonight, as you know, maybe it's well we can't. But one of the things that amazes a reader of these chapters is the sheer number of all these things. Somebody has counted them from these earlier chapters right through. They say there are well over 300 different precepts. the number of them. And another thing that impresses a person that reads these chapters is that these precepts that God gives, they cover every area of life. They touch a man's marriage. They touch how he bakes his food. They touch the arrangements of his toilet. They touch the weights and measures on his scales. Now, the amazing thing to me is, there's hardly a mention in all of these chapters to the tabernacle. You say, but isn't that the whole thing? Shouldn't God be interested in the tabernacle and say that in the tabernacle behave yourself, and when you're in the courts of the tabernacle, bring me the proper sacrifices, and when you're in associated behind that lovely white linen cloth, you make sure that you behave properly. Holiness becometh my house, and you better behave yourself when you're in my sanctuary. Yes, God was interested in it, but you see here, he talks about their home. He talks about their relations. He talks about their friends. He talks about their food. He talks about their family. He talks about their dress. Because the people who are going to be associated with God's place, God has an interest in every detail of their lives. And he has an interest in them 24/7. Mind you, that's a very, in itself, that's a very, very far-reaching principle. You see, dear Christians, let us remember that God's not just interested in how I behave in the hall. I know there's nothing consecrated about the assembly, about the building, I'm just using that expression. He's not just interested how I behave in the hall, he's interested how I behave in all the different departments of my life. And another thing that you'll notice, just very closely linked with that, and it has posed a problem to all the students. I'm not trying to solve it, although I think there is a solution, but I'm not even going to that tonight. The whole thing seems to be mixed up. One minute you're reading about the man's marriage. Then the next thing you're reading about a donkey or something. And then the next thing you're reading about going to battle. And then the next thing you read about vineyard. And then the next thing you read about the house of God. Why do you not keep all the things together about vineyards? And keep all the ones about marriage? And keep all the parts about the house of God? Why not keep them all, but mix them, throw them in, one into another? Why do you not at least have them in some kind of orderly arrangement? Now, I suspect there may be an arrangement, but it's not obvious. Now, one of the lessons I can learn from that is this, that our lives are not in compartments. You know, a man says, what I do in my business is my own business. That's nothing to do with the assembly. I do my business whatever way I like. A man in government, for example, a man in Congress, or as we talk about the House of Commons, he can have an affair. He can have an affair with anyone. That's nothing to do with his seat in Congress. That's nothing to do with his place in the Senate. That's nothing to do with his place in the House of Commons or the House of Lords. He says, this is my official life. The other is my personal and my private life. I can live as I wish on that side of the boundary. It has nothing to do with my life on this side, because my official life and my personal life are two totally different departments. When you come to the Bible, it's exactly the opposite. How your business is run, dear brother, impacts your family life. How your business life touches your family life will impact your assembly life. That's very obvious from the New Testament, and especially obvious from 1 Timothy chapter 3, when the Apostle Paul, speaking about overseers, he says, how can a man take care of the church of God if he can't rule his own house? But you say, sure, it's nothing to do with it. If a man has an official position, if you're going to talk in those unbiblical terms, if a man has an official position as an overseer in the assembly, that's one department, and sure, he has his own life and his own family, that's nothing to do with it. The Apostle Paul says it has everything to do with it, and we cannot compartmentalize our lives, because God's word, it touches every one of these different departments. Now, to make some kind of understanding of what we have in these chapters, I think we need to grasp very clearly. Now, I'm just going to take my time for a minute or two to emphasize this. We need to grasp very clearly the purpose that God had. Now, I've talked about the plurality of these regulations. And I've talked about the presentation of them, all mixed in through each other, as far as it seems. And I've talked about the practicality of them. Now, fourthly, I want to speak about the purpose that God had in giving these very, very down-to-earth, nitty-gritty, rubber-hit-the-road, detailed instructions. I've already mentioned it, but just to elaborate. God was telling the people these things in detail so that they might live a life entirely different to the Canaanites that were in the land before them. The Canaanites had their day. You remember even way back in the days of Abraham, God said, "Now I have seen all this." And he says, "I'm most unhappy with the way these Canaanites are living." And he said, "The time's going to come." He said, "If these Canaanites go on dealing the way they deal," he says, "I'm going to have to clear them out." And he said, "What I did to Sodom and Gomorrah, that was on the edge of the land," he said, that was a cancerous lump of immorality. And he said, "If I had allowed that cancerous, malignant piece of humanity to stay as it was in its most virulent form," he says, "it was going to contaminate the gene pool of the human race." So he said, "As the sovereign surgeon," he said, "I took my knife. And," he said, "I carved out of planet Earth a chunk of ground." And he left a scar. The surgeon left a scar that was caused by sodomy. And that scar can still be seen on the surface of the globe. And topographers and geologists and geographers, they're still amazed at the Dead Sea. They can't understand it, because God has left a permanent scar as a result of his surgery. And it was bad then, but he said, "Now I tell you what," he said, "I'll just take it easy." And he said, "I'll give them another 400 years and see how they get on." The 400 years are now up. This time God doesn't send a fire and brimstone from heaven. He says, "Joshua, you take your sword and you go in and do the job for me." He said, "These people haven't changed. I gave them a big warning 4 centuries ago. I sent brimstone and fire." He said, "I warned them." And he said, "Having warned them, I waited." And he said, "They won't repent. They're worse than ever." He said, "The corruption has compounded." And he said, "I'm about now to march in with my Israelitish armies." And he said, "I will clear the soil again." And he said, "When I put you people in," he said, "I don't want you to start messing around the same way as they messed around. Because if I put them out, I'll have to put you out." And we know that sadly that's what happened. They did mess around so much that God had to put them out after a number of years. Now, there were maybe four features of that culture that I just want to mention quickly. First of all, Canaanitish culture, it was very much a counterfeit culture. They dealt in substitutes and images and imitations. They had images of gods that couldn't speak. They had mouths but couldn't speak, and eyes that couldn't see, and ears that couldn't hear, and feet that couldn't walk, and hands that couldn't move. They all looked the part, but they were counterfeit. And they couldn't deliver the goods. Now, God didn't like that, because God is the true God and the real God. And anything that is imitation, it really displeases God. Because he is true to the very core of his being. And he expects us to be a true people. Canaanitish culture was counterfeit. Mind you, if I were back in my own country, I would be saying British culture is counterfeit. But seeing where I am tonight, is it not true, dear people, that American culture is very counterfeit? I can see driving through some of this pleasant countryside and into some of the villages and towns and cities, and I look at the advertising and so on. I can see that this is a land of dreadful idolatry. People bow at the shrine of materialism. People are bowing at the altar of secularism. And they hope that the God of materialism will be able to give to them status and significance and satisfaction. And they bow down at the totem pole of toys. And they haven't yet learned that those gods cannot deliver the goods. And the counterfeits have deceived this nation as it has the nation to which I belong back at home. And God said, take away the shall. And he said, establish a testimony that will let the people get to know the true God. Someone that can satisfy them and save them and can bless them. We should let the people know that it is God, that our satisfaction is in God, not in things. Not in things. But more of that just in a minute. With that counterfeit culture, there was, of course, an awful corruption and an awful carnality, and the moral standards, they were abysmally low. Now just give me a minute, because I'm not preaching on now. I gather that you don't like long sermons, so we'll just have to cut the Bible down to suit our appetites as much as possible, and folks have a long distance to travel. There was awful corruption. You see, the culture, the worship of Canaan was, now listen carefully to this, and I hope I don't offend anybody, but I'll go as easy as I can, and I'll do my best to stop when I should stop in this particular point. The religion of Canaan was more or less a fertility cult. Now what they worshipped, and what they wanted, was good crops. And they wanted the rejuvenation of the crops every spring. And they wanted the germination of the seed every spring. And the maturing of the crops in every harvest and so on. And they worshipped their gods so that the ground would get fertility and germination and reproduction. Now I'm selecting my words there. When it came to, for example, and this will only be one example, when it came to the spring festival, we need to please the gods. So what we will have one great big dance around the groves. And these dances will be right across the land, and all the boys and all the girls will have a wonderful piece of game. And if we can demonstrate fertility, human fertility, and if we can demonstrate it in the most imaginative manner, that will induce the gods also to cavort. And they in turn will induce the crops to germinate and reproduce. But the more that we do here, the more they will do there. And the more they do there, as a result of the more we do here, the more will happen in the fields and in the olive groves and in the vineyards. And I can tell you, I'm leaving a good little bit to your imagination. They had girls there, and they had some men dressed up as girls, and they had some wonderful games. And there's not a nightclub, well, maybe I should be careful, but I think I can say this, there's hardly a nightclub in the USA in 2006 that would compete with the carnality and the corruption of the Canaanitish fertility rites. It was just abominable. You talk about lewdness, you talk about pornography, you talk about perversity, don't even mention it. And God was sending his people into the midst of that culture, into the teeth of the worst culture that the world has ever seen. It had plunged the very abyss of evil and abomination. Now he says, they have a counterfeit culture where they worship gods that can't deliver. They have a carnal culture that involves itself in all kinds of reproductive techniques of the vilest type. Then, associated with that, they had a very cruel culture. We read there in one of the passages, God told them, he said, to put their children through the fire. Come on now, some of you ladies, imagine taking some of your little infants, some of you grandmothers taking some of your children, and you're going to put them through the fire. And the smell of burning flesh, it mingles with some of the smells of promiscuity. And while the infants are burning to ashes, to the honor of Molech, other children are being produced. I think I better stop there. And this is all that goes on. It's carnality plus cruelty. It was based, and as far as old people were concerned, in ancient Kenya, they didn't care tuppence about them. If you were too old to join the games, just dump you. Dump you. So that here's a culture that is so covetous and is so carnal and is so indulgent that it lives at the expense of infant. And it also lives at the expense of the old. You say, well, isn't that dreadful? Is America any better? What about the aborted babies that we put in black bags and drop into incinerators? We are more sophisticated, but we are no less sinful. And the British nation, it shares the blood of aborted babes on the hands of its politicians and its health service. You see, this is the culture. We live in the culture of Canaan. It's cruelty. It's carnality. And it's counterfeit. It's all here. Just exactly, you say, but the book of Deuteronomy is a book of ways. Sure, it's desperate stuff that you read that stuff. I don't know what you're talking about. Why didn't you read some of Paul's epistles? Are you sure? I tell you, if you're Paul here, he loved the book of Deuteronomy. I'm going to show you that. I'll show you that maybe about 25 past 9 or so. Now, there's another side to that culture. And it was all the craft of consultation with the dead. Necromancers, hydromancy, cutting up the innards of birds, fortune tellers, dabbling with the occult, virulent forms of black magic, soothsayers, prophetesses, diviners, they had them all. This land had been invaded by the underworld, the covert underworld of demonology. This land of Canaan. Is this land not nearly covered with the same thing? You know, I'll not speak about America because I really don't know. And you know amongst the Christians, I enjoy nothing but the best and the atmosphere of the Lord's people. I'm talking about the culture. We have to live in this, brethren and sisters. God, you say, you know, I hear people say, all the time I hear people say, you know, it's awful days that we live in. It's awful days that we live in. And our young people, they haven't a chance. And it's tough times. And like it's much worse than it was when we were born back there in 1912. And the young people like they never, and people don't be talking tommy rot. You have to learn that word, Brother William told me you didn't know. That's just pious piffle. What do you mean they never? I tell you, there's nothing as far as culture and corruption and dealing with the dead and demonology and Ouija boards and all, there's nothing that goes on in America in 2006 that didn't already happen in Canaan. And God put his people into the teeth of it. And if they were able to survive in it, there's no excuse for us. Never you say that nobody else ever had it as difficult. I tell you, dear people, Corinth, the ancient city of Corinth, Las Vegas was like a Sunday school party compared to it. And yet there was an assembly there, and God could sustain his people. And as people abandon the Bible and the Judeo-Christian principles of the Bible and turn away from Bible literacy, it opens the floodgates for the invasion of all this kind of Oriental mysticism. It was all here. Now God said, I'm going to tell you people how to live in a way that will be a protest against that form of conduct. He said, let your lifestyle in every department, let it be a total protest. He said, the way that you look after your children, let it